Devim Sarasvatim Vyasam.
Devim Sarasvatim Vyasam.
Atojayam Udirayat.
Nashta
Prayeshu Abhadreshu.
Nityam Bhagavata
Sevaya.
Bhagavati
Uttama Shloke. Bhaktir Bhavati Naishtiki. Before reciting the Srimad Bhagavatam, which is the very means of conquest, one should offer respectful obeisances unto the personality of Godhead, Narayan, unto Naranarayan Rishi, the supermost human, unto Mother Saraswati, the goddess of learning, and unto Srila Vyasadeva, the author. By regular attendance and classes on the Bhagavatam, and by rendering of service to the pure devotee, all that is troublesome to the heart is almost completely destroyed, and loving service unto the personality of Godhead, who is praised with transcendental songs, is established as an irrevocable fact. Thank you for allowing me to speak on the Bhagavatam today. I request the blessings of the senior Vaishnavas, as well as all the other Vaishnavas, that I may say something useful today. So we are in Canto 1, Chapter 4, the appearance of Narada. We're doing three shlokas today, 1, 4, 14 through 16. So I thought we would say the first two collectively all together, and we'll do the last one responsibly. So 14 is Shuta Vacha, altogether. Cha Vapare Samanam Prakte Tritya Yuga Paryaye Jata Parasharad Yogi Vasavyam Kalaya Hare. Translation. Sutta Goswami said, when the second millennium overlapped the third, the great sage Vyasadeva was born to Parashara in the womb of Satyavati, the daughter of Vasu. Purport. There is a chronological order of the four millenniums, namely Satya, Dwapara, Treta, and Kali. But sometimes there is overlapping. During the regime of Vaivasvata Manu, which is our current Manu, the seventh Manu, there was an overlapping of the 28th round of the four millenniums, that's our current Chaturyuga, the 28th, and the third millennium appeared prior to the second. So Treta came before Dwapara in our current Chaturyuga. In that particular millennium, Lord Sri Krishna also descends. And because of this, there was some particular alteration. The mother of the great sage was Satyavati, the daughter of Vasu, fisherman. And the father was the great Parashara Muni. That is the history of Vyasadeva's birth. Every millennium is divided into three periods, and each period is called the Sandhya. Vyasadeva appeared in the third Sandhya of that particular age. So the third Sandhya of the current Chaturyuga, Dwapara Yuga, which in this round of millenniums comes right before our Kali Yuga, which we're in now. So 15, let's say all together. Sakadachit Sarasvatya. Upasrishya jalam suchihi vihikta eka asina udite ravi mandale. Translation. Once upon a time, he, Vyasadeva, as the sun rose, took his morning ablution in the waters of the Saraswati and sat alone to concentrate. Purport. The river Saraswati is flowing in the Bhadarik Ashram area of the Himalayas. So the place indicated here is Shanya Pras in Bhadarika Ashram, where Sri Vyasadeva is residing. Notice the present tense, is residing. And 16 will say responsibly, Paravaragya Sarishi, Kalina Vyaktaram Hasa, Yuga Dharma Vyatikaram, Praptam Bhuvi Yuge Yuge, Paravaragyasarishi.
Kalinavyaktaram hasa.
Yugadharma vyatikaram.
Praptam bhuvi yuge yuge.
Paravaragya sarishi.
Kalinavyaktaram hasa.
Yugadharma vyatikaram.
Paptam bhuvi yuge yuge.
Paravaragya sarishi.
Kalinavyaktaram hasa.
Yugadharma vyatikaram.
Praptam bhuvi yuge yuge.
Paravaragya sarishi.
Kalinavyaktaram hasa.
Yugadharma vyatikaram.
Paptam bhuvi yuge yuge.
Paravaragya sarishi.
Kalinavyaktaram hasa.
Yugadharma vyatikaram.
Paptam bhuvi yuge yuge.
Paravaragya sarishi.
Kalinavyaktaram hasa.
Yugadharma vyatikaram.
Paptam bhuvi yuge yuge.
Paravaragya sarishi.
Kalinavyaktaram hasa.
Yugadharma vyatikaram.
Paptam bhuvi yuge yuge.
Synonyms, you like to join in, please join in. Paravara, past and future. Gya, one who knows. Sa, he. Rishi, Vyasadev. Kalina, by time. Avyakta, unmanifested. Rampasa, by great force. Yugadharma, acts in terms of the millennium. Vyatikaram, anomalies. Praptam, having accrued. Bhuvi, on the earth. Yuge, yuge, different ages. Translation by Srila Prabhupada. The great sage Vyasadeva saw anomalies in the duties of the millennium. This happens on the earth in different ages due to the unseen force of time. I'll say it one more time. Please join in if you'd like. The great sage Vyasadeva saw anomalies in the duties of the millennium. This happens on the earth in different ages due to the unseen force of time. Report. The great sages, like Vyasadeva, are liberated souls, and therefore they can see clearly past and future. Thus he could see the future anomalies in the Kali age, and accordingly he made arrangement for the people in general, so that they can execute a progressive life in this age, which is full of darkness. The people in general in this age of Kali are too much interested in matter, which is temporary. Because of ignorance, they are unable to evaluate the essence of life and be enlightened in spiritual knowledge. I'll just say that again. Because of ignorance, they are unable to evaluate the essence of life and be enlightened in spiritual knowledge. Om Agyana Timiran Vasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshur Umlitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Pancha Kalpatarubhyascha Kripa Sindhubhya Evacha Patitanam Pavanabhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha. So later in this chapter, we find out what happens with the progress of time, and particularly in our current Kali Yuga, is that the power of material objects deteriorates by the influence of time. The duration of the material body is reduced, memory is reduced, and good qualities and intelligence are reduced. The action of matter becomes slower. That's really interesting. Land, and therefore, the land does not produce food grains in same proportions. The cow does not give as much milk, and therefore the people in general do not have enough nourishing foods. So this is what causes the people to be less intelligent in Kali Yuga and slower. And we can sort of see this happening a little bit already, this not enough nourishing foods and the food markets being, you know, so polluted with all kinds of poisons and GMOs. Thus the great sage Vyasadeva, who is very kind to the ignorant masses, edited the Vedas so they might be assimilated by less intellectual men. So out of his mercy, Srila Vyasadeva saw that this would happen and all these anomalies in our current age. And as we know, he took the one Veda and he divided it into four to make it more, the people can assimilate it more easily. And then ultimately he wrote the Srimad Bhagavatam, which the Puranas are considered the fifth Veda. So I wanted to talk about this statement in the purport, which says, the people in Kali Yuga are too much interested in matter, which is temporary. And because of ignorance, they do not know that spiritual life is actually their asset in life. So they put all their faith into matter. And we can see how, in the world out there, this word religion has become almost like a dirty word. Like, you know, if you say that out there, it's sort of like, what do you mean religion? We notice that consumerism is very important, especially in America. In general, there's no thought of death or afterlife. You know, people aren't thinking about the next life or that they're going to die or what's going to happen when they die. And we can see that the people are not performing any austerities or any yagyas. And also I was thinking how they're not aware of the fact that there's a court of Yamaraj and that all their actions are being judged. And everything's being recorded, and you know, after death, they're going to have to answer to Yamaraj. So the general populace in Kali Yuga is not at all aware of all these things. They don't know what is good for them. So I found a purport in the first canto, second chapter, we heard, you know, not too long ago, and it sort of describes the situation nicely. This is 1.2.10, the completely bewildered material civilization is wrongly directed towards the fulfillment of desires in sense gratification. In such a civilization, in all spheres of life, the ultimate end is sense gratification. In politics, social service, altruism, philanthropy, and ultimately in religion, or even in salvation, the very same tint of sense gratification is ever increasingly predominant. In a political field, the leaders of men fight with one another to fulfill their personal sense gratification. The voters adore the so-called leaders only when they promise sense gratification. As soon as the voters are dissatisfied in their own sense of satisfaction, they dethrone the leaders. The leaders must always disappoint the voters by not satisfying their senses. The same is applicable in all other fields. No one is serious about the problems of life. It's very true, isn't it? But the Bhagavatam says that one should not live for sense gratification. One should satisfy the senses only in so much as required for self-preservation and not for sense gratification. Because the body is made of senses, which also require a certain amount of satisfaction, there are regulative directions for satisfaction of such senses. But the senses are not meant for unrestricted enjoyment. So this idea of regulative sense gratification, which we all need, you know, some level of sense gratification. We cannot completely avoid it, but we have to do it in a regulated way and according to the Vedas. Because what is this unrestricted sense enjoyment? Can somebody say something about that? What is it? I'll say a little bit about it, but does anybody want to say anything about it? Yes. Can you give him a microphone?
Yes. What are the foremost sense enjoyment? Srila Prabhupada said the topmost is sex life. Within the material world, everyone thinks that that's the norm to engage regularly in that connection. See? So that's one, then intoxicants.
Yes.
And now intoxicants have moved to a higher level. It's not only alcohol, but it's all forms of dope. And not only that, now painkillers become
Yeah, thank you. Right.
And then, you know, the others, like meat eating, that's a norm. Killing animals is,
yes.
You know, especially the cow. You know, that is such a horrible act, but yet it becomes the norm.
It's the norm. It's considered very tasty.
Yeah.
Beef.
And of course, yes. You know?
Yes, thank you. I was thinking this idea of sense gratification, this is our material disease that we come into this world with, right? And if we don't have a higher taste, and if we don't have higher information, it's, you know, that's what we want, because we're designed to seek pleasure. So this is our original disease that we came into this world with, and that we have to reverse through the process of devotional service, and through some regulated sense gratification. So it's not that we completely, you know, do away with it. You know, we do it in a regulated way. Prahlad Maharaj says that a life of sense gratification is very risky. Why? Because if one has not engaged in tapasya in this life, he must certainly get a life like cat, dog, or hog. Right? So he says it's very risky, and if we don't engage in tapasya, we have to fall down. We have to get a lower body than the current human body, which is a very great boon for performing devotional service. And if we don't utilize it to that end, then we will by default go down and get a lower body. So we can think how this is the faith of most people who are not performing devotional service, not performing yajñas. They're going to get, you know, a lower body, which is, you know, that's totally miserable and a misuse of the human life. I was thinking how, well, you know, the jiva soul has two choices when he comes into the material world, and they're side by side, and he gets to choose whether he's going to engage in sense gratification or whether he's going to engage in devotional service. So the jiva makes the choice. And if he chooses sense gratification, that's, you know, a dead end, and he's going to get a lower body. And it'll be hard to rise up again to the human body. Or he can choose to elevate himself, use this human body properly, and engage in devotional service. And there's a shloka in the Bhagavad Gita about this incompatibility between sense gratification and devotion to Krishna. It's 244, Bhogaishwarya Prasaktanam. Taya parita chetasam yavasayatmika buddhi samadhana vidyate. In the minds of those who are too attached to sense enjoyment and material opulence, and who are bewildered by such things, the resolute determination for devotional service to the Supreme Lord does not take place. So it sort of makes sense, right? Like, what happens when you don't perform enough, when you don't engage in regulated sense enjoyment, and you engage in unrestricted sense enjoyment, like, what happens? What happens to your mind? Right? It becomes completely like you're not able to at all think clearly or think straight. And so we can see how unregulated sense enjoyment is not at all compatible with yajna or austerities. And in that same purport, Prabhupada says that samadhi is never possible for persons interested in material sense gratification. And who are bewildered by such things, they are more or less condemned by the process of material energy, right? So they fall under Mahamaya, right? If you engage in sense gratification, you're choosing the external potency, and if you engage in devotional service, you're choosing Krishna's internal potency. I wanted to quickly talk about this statement in a purport which says the degradation happens due to unforeseen forces of time. So how this time factor has a degrading effect on pure knowledge. And it's this time which causes the degradation that causes the anomalies, our current anomalies in Kali Yuga. And we'll get into those anomalies in a bit. Anomalies in the duties of the millennium. So Krishna says the same thing in the Gita. He tells Arjuna that in 4.2, that this supreme science was thus received through the chain of the cyclic succession. This is about the Gita, but same applies to the Bhagavatam. And the saintly kings understood it in that way, but in the course of time, the succession was broken, and therefore the science as it is appears to be lost. So again, in the course of time, the succession was broken, and therefore the science is lost. And the Sanskrit for that, in that shloka, is sakalaneha. And we also see the same word in today's shloka, in the course of time. And what happens to the knowledge? Yoga nashta parantapa. Nashta means scattered. So in the course of time, the knowledge becomes scattered. And so what happens when knowledge, pure knowledge, becomes scattered and religion declines and irreligion increases, what happens then?
Krishna appears.
Yes, thank you. Exactly. 4.7. Anytime that there's decline in religion and a rise of irreligion, yuge, Krishna comes millennium after millennium. So we know that in Kali Yuga, he comes as Lord Chaitanya, but he also descends as the literary incarnation, as the Srimad Bhagavatam. And we just heard recently in the last chapter that through the Bhagavatam, through hearing the Bhagavatam and assimilating the messages of the Bhagavatam, Krishna manifests where? In our heart. So that is how Krishna appears in Kali Yuga, through the Bhagavatam, and he appears in our heart. And we know that Vyasadeva was also and is also an incarnation of Krishna. So Krishna finds a way to appear, right, to correct the situation of the Kali Yuga, to correct this rise of irreligion. So I wanted to talk a little bit about specifically Kali Yuga, the anomalies that are mentioned in this section. So in the 12th canto, we know that as the age of Kali progresses, all good qualities of men diminish, and all impure qualities increase. Atheistic systems of so-called religion become predominant, replacing the codes of Vedic law. Atheistic systems of so-called religion become predominant, replacing the codes of Vedic law. So, somebody can think of any atheistic systems of so-called religion that are replacing Vedic laws in our current age. If you'd like to share, one thing that comes to my mind immediately is this Mayavad, right? Mayavad yoga philosophy, which is so prevalent in the world, which is not really religion, but it's taken as religion. Scientology, thank you.
Yeah.
It says in the 12th canto how in Kali Yuga, atheistic systems of so-called religion become predominant and they replace Vedic law. So if anybody could say any, what are these atheistic systems of so-called religion that are taken as religion in our current age? We said Mayavad philosophy, somebody said Scientology.
Prosperity religion.
Yes, prosperity religion. It's very, very popular. The Secret, right, is one example of that. But there are so many of these, and they call themselves Christians, many of them, right? But it's like not Christianity at all. It's all about like manifesting abundance and wealth. This is like very, very popular now. So it's not at all about austerity. You know, it's not at all about yajna. It's quite the opposite. It's like very demoniac. Anyone else?
I was thinking that Buddhism to some degree, because even though it's religious in nature, but the end result, there's no God, no soul.
Absolutely.
So it leads to a hidden atheism.
Absolutely. And it's very similar. It's this Mayavad idea, which has the garb of religion, right? Praying with folded hands and mantras, and it looks like religion, but it's actually quite atheistic. It's covered atheism, yes.
Demigod worship also, right?
Demigod worship. Yeah, it falls under Mayavad. Falls under Mayavad. Mm-hmm. So I just love this 12th canto where it talks about all the different characteristics of Kali Yuga, because we can see it manifesting so clearly. And, you know, there's a whole long list, but I just wanted to touch on a few of them and then talk more about those. Religion, truthfulness, cleanliness, tolerance, mercy, duration of life, physical strength, and memory will all diminish day by day because of the powerful influence of the age of Kali. Religion, truthfulness, cleanliness, tolerance, mercy, duration of life, physical strength, and memory. So it's sort of saying the same thing in our current shlokas today. In Kali Yuga, wealth alone will be considered the sign of a man's good birth, proper behavior, and fine qualities. Law and justice will be applied only on the basis of one's power. A person's spiritual position will be ascertained merely according to external symbols. And on that same basis, people will change from one spiritual order to the next. A sacred place will be taken to consist of no more than a reservoir of water located at a distance. Right? All these like spiritual retreats that have nothing to do with Krishna. They're all like pretty and, you know, it's like a come to paradise, do yoga in paradise. There's no Krishna in that at all. And beauty will be thought to depend on one's hairstyle. Filling the belly will become the goal of life. The principles of religion will be observed only for the sake of reputation. As the earth thus becomes crowded with corrupt population, whoever among any of the social classes shows himself to be the strongest will gain political power. So in that context, I wanted to talk about leaders in Kali Yuga, right? It says that law and justice will be applied only on the basis of one's power, and one who shows himself to be the strongest will gain political power. Srila Prabhupada talks about, in the seventh canto, about two types of kings. There's the Grihamedinam king, and then there's the Rajarshi. And Hiranyakashipu and Prahlad are the examples of the two. And the Grihamedinam king, he is attached to kingly life of sense enjoyment. And the Rajarshi is obviously a king who has ruling power, but who is saintly. And Prabhupada says, very interestingly, Hiranyakashipu wanted to keep Prahlad in mundane attachment as a Grihamedinam type of king, but Prahlad was above the modes and was a Rajarshi. Right? He was trying to teach him diplomacy and politics and economic development. And, you know, Prahlad wasn't interested in all that. So I was thinking, if one is not a Rajarshi, which is pretty much the case in Kali Yuga, like there's no Rajarshis at all. And also in prior Yugas, we'll give some examples of that. If he's not a Rajarshi, he cannot like rule effectively because he becomes corrupted by that power. He becomes intoxicated by his power, right? There's that, I guess you can call it like a sutra, absolute power corrupts absolutely. And we can see how Hiranyakashipu became completely intoxicated on his power, and he caused all sort of havoc in the universe. And then later on, Mother Bhumi also had to complain to Lord Brahma and complain to Lord Vishnu about the demoniac kings on the earth. She became overburdened by them because they were causing all sorts of calamities. So it's very delicate, this position of a king, and if you know one is not a Rajarshi, he will get polluted by that absolute power. It seems that, so I thought, this Griha Medinam kings, if one is not a Rajarshi, it seems like they become corrupted by that absolute power, and they themselves want to be worshipped instead of worshipping Krishna. We can see one example of this in the Bhagavatam is King Vena. When the king ascended to the throne, he became all-powerful with the eight kinds of opulences. Consequently, he became, what happens? They become too proud. By virtue of his false prestige, he considered himself to be greater than anyone. Thus, he began to insult great personalities. Right, he caused all kinds of problems owing to him being a Griha Medinam king who was intoxicated by his own power. And he made the statement that those who out of gross ignorance do not worship the king, who is actually the Supreme Personality of Godhead, they experience neither happiness in this world nor in the world after death. So the same thing happened with Hiranyakashipu. Like, he did away with all austerities, he did away with all worship, and he himself wanted to be worshipped as the Supreme. And what happened? The great sages, they had to kill him. And I wanted to briefly mention two examples of Rajarshis. We already said Prahlad Maharaj. Can anybody name some Rajarshis in the Bhagavatam? Prithu, exactly. So I wanted to talk about these two, Prithu and Yudhishthir. This king, Maharaj Prithu, is the best among those who are following religious principles. As such, he will engage everyone in the pursuit of religious principles and give those principles all protection. He will also be a great chastiser to the irreligious and the atheistic. So Rajarshi engages everyone in devotional service, and he protects and follows religious principles. He will be able in due course of time to maintain all living entities and to keep them in a pleasant condition by manifesting himself as different demigods to perform various departmental activities. This King Prithu will be as powerful as the sun god, and just as the sun god equally distributes his sunshine to everyone, King Prithu will distribute his mercy equally. Similarly, just as the sun god evaporates water for 8 months and during the rainy season returns it profusely, this king will also exact taxes from the citizens and return these monies in times of need. Can you imagine? He will exact taxes and return these monies in times of need. That's actually where our tax money is supposed to go. But we don't even want to think about where our tax money goes. So what makes a Rajarshi versus a Griha Medinam king? He is a devotee of Krishna. And they're able to be so successful as king, it's not by their own doing, but because they're devotees, they receive the mercy of Krishna to be able to rule effectively. And this Prabhupada says this in 1:8, the king of heaven is thousands and thousands of times greater than Maharaj Yudhishthir in opulence, yet the fame of Maharaj Yudhishthir was not less. The reason is that Maharaj Yudhishthir was a pure devotee of the Lord, and by his grace only was King Yudhishthir on the level of the king of heaven, even though he performed only 3 yajñas, whereas the king of heaven performed hundreds. That is the prerogative of the devotee of the Lord. So this is where their Rajarshis get their empowerment, is because of mercy, because they're performing devotional service to Krishna, and through Krishna's mercy, they are able to rule effectively. It's not by their own doing. So all these leaders that we talked about, they're not Kali Yuga leaders. What to speak of Kali Yuga, right? There are no Rajarshis in Kali Yuga. There are some that are better than others. Some leaders, you know, some may have some noble qualities. Not today. Maybe more towards the beginning of Kali Yuga. I was thinking of like the Roman emperors, you know, 1200 years when Rome was in power. And some of them were very noble and very good and, you know, not many. And many of them were like very, very bad, you know, very demoniac. I was thinking if we could, before the class ends, mention two Kali Yuga leaders and just kind of, you know, analyze them and talk about how, you know, they're definitely not Rajarshis. And even if they actually may have like some quote unquote good reputation, right, they've actually maybe risen to power through evil means or have, you know, made some, caused a lot of havoc in our world. So I wanted to look at one of them. I wanted to look at this Julius Caesar, right, who was during the time of Rome, about 50 years before Christ, and who, you know, many would think of Julius Caesar as, oh, like he was so great. You know, the Romans certainly thought he was so great. Afterwards, after he died, you know, they sort of always talked about him and worshipped him, you know, and he was such a powerful statesman, and he was so, he was such an amazing general and military leader, and he did a lot of good for the Roman populace, which, you know, some of that is true, but he also did a lot of bad things, and he rose to power in a horrible way, in a very demoniac way. You know, they all start out, these Kali Yuga leaders, they all start out kind of making a lot of promises, right, and portraying themselves as like good and modest, and I want to help the people. And Caesar was always known as saying, I just want what's good for Rome. Everything that I do is for the good of Rome, right? And he was a very powerful orator, and he was able to speak to the masses, and he was able to inspire them, you know, and you see this vision for Rome, you know, just think about Rome. You know, and people followed him as a result, and they idolized him. And also, he was a very skilled military general. So, you know, what happened? How did he come to power? Basically, he waged an illegal war. You know, Rome was already pretty expansive at that time, you know, but he, and many of these Roman emperors did that. They had to, like, go out and conquer more and conquer more and conquer more just for the sake of conquering. You know, they were always put it under the moniker of, like, this is for the glory of Rome. I'm only doing it for the glory of Rome. But it wasn't, it wasn't really the case. It was for their own, like, personal aggrandizement. And basically how Caesar came to power is that he attacked the Gauls, which were their predecessor to the current French people, who were, they were friends of the Romans. They were paying taxes to Romans, they were allies. And he decided to, you know, wage war on them for his own glory and to expand, you know, Rome proper. And he waged this horrible 8-year war on them. And the Senate in Rome was telling him, no, you know, this is an illegal war. You cannot, you know, wage war on our friends. They're paying taxes. They're our allies. You know, but he was there for 8 years, and he conquered them. And he not only conquered them, but he killed, you know, he committed, like, genocide of those people, and he enslaved them. You know, and after 8 years of warfare, he was basically a war criminal. You know, and the Senate was like, don't come back here, you're a war criminal. You know, you waged an illegal war, you know, for 8 years. Can you imagine all the killing that was taking place for 8 years and all those soldiers that had to die for, you know, just for his own personal aggrandizement? So what did Caesar do? He crossed the Rubicon, which is like the border of Rome proper, Italian Rome. They were not supposed to come back to Rome with armed forces, but he took his forces and he crossed the Rubicon and he came back into Rome, and he basically attacked Rome, and there was a civil war for 4 years, and out of that civil war, he emerged victorious, and that's how he came into power. So this is how Caesar, you know, came into power. It was through an illegal war and through genocide. And there's so many examples in Kali Yuga. I mean, we could just go on and on. Well, I had another example, but in the interest of time, I'll stop with Caesar. I'm just going to talk about Henry VIII. So, to just quickly wrap up, so what is the solution for all this, for these anomalies of Kali Yuga, right? So, Vyasadeva gave us the solution. The solution is Srimad Bhagavatam. This Bhagavad Purana propounds the highest truth. The highest truth is reality distinguished from illusion for the welfare of all. Such truth uproots the threefold miseries. This beautiful Bhagavatam, compiled by the great sage Vyasadeva, is sufficient in itself for God realization. As soon as one attentively and submissively hears the message of Bhagavatam, by this culture of knowledge, the Supreme Lord is established within the heart. So that's how Krishna appears in Kali Yuga. He's established within the heart through the Bhagavatam. And just lastly, by propagating the Srimad Bhagavatam, the polluted atmosphere of this world is changed. A saintly person is always absorbed in glorifying the Supreme Lord, because by broadcasting the holy name and fame of the Supreme Lord, the polluted atmosphere of the world will change, and as a result of propagating the transcendental literature, Srimad Bhagavatam, the people will become sane in their transactions. So please let me know what are the discussion points. Thank you. I'll start there and then you.
Very well, thank you, very nice. If you go back to the purport, and the first purport of the first verse you read, it has Vasu, and then it has in bracket fisherman.
Yes.
But Vasu was not the fisherman. He was the biological father of Satyavati, but he was a king. Vasu. The fisherman was Dusaraj. So I think maybe the editors of BPG.
No. Vasu, semen, sent by arrow, and fish was caught.
Maybe it means like that's the definition of the word.
Uparichar Basu is a famous king. He's one of the Jamaraja's entourage, also Indra's entourage. Let me finish. When he passed Simen, it's a Tamoshmi Bharatar Shava. He did not want to waste it because his wife was not there. So he packed it. I don't know how he packed it. Yeah. He sent it to the place where the child should be born, but somehow or other it dropped into the Jamuna and the fish ate. And when fish ate, and the fisher king who caught this fish, and when they cut the stomach, they found this child. That's how Saptavati is born. So both are correct. This is correct what it says. The person who raised the child is also father.
Yes,
seven father, like seven mother. Well, so it's correct whatever the text says.
And I have a quick question. So it stated that Treta Yoga switches place at Dwarpa.
Yeah.
But Treta Yoga would have already occurred.
Yeah.
Would have already taken place. And then Dwarpa Yoga comes into place. So I'm thinking that Dwarpa Yoga took the position of Treta Yoga.
Exactly.
The atmosphere and everything like that.
Oh, probably. I would imagine that was the case. Do you know for sure?
Yes, because of the compassion of Mother Ahulla.
She was crying so desperately. She was begging her husband Gautam Muni, please, I'm sorry I did this mistake. Please forgive me. I can't wait for that long. Then Gautam Muni, out of compassion, he switched. He had a power to switch the millennium. Mm-hmm. And as a result, Treta came before Dwapara.
But it's a same
It's supposed to
atmosphere.
Be Sapta, Dapara, Treta, Kali. So
no, I know, but what he's saying is that the atmosphere of Dwapara
Yuga
is like Treta Yuga.
Yes. Just like an example Prabhupada gave, the worshipping, deity worshipping, it's supposed to be when? Dwapara. But in Treta, they started deity worship. Mm. Why? And Prabhupada gave a very nice purport in ninth canto that the sages saw the disrespect between the lower human being, and immediately they installed the deity because they already lost the respect to the devotees, senior devotees, and without deity, they will be completely finished, doomed. So out of compassion, the sages started worshipping the deity, even in Treta Yuga, which is not for deity worship.
So it had the atmosphere of Draupadi.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Thank
you. It's adjusting. Mm-hmm. The compassion is adjusting.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to say, you gave a very nice explanation on negative leaders of Kali Yuga. I have a positive leaders of ISKCON leaders.
Yes, I meant to mention Srila Prabhupada, but yes.
Can I give just
please
few?
Do. Mm-hmm.
Because I just went for the training. It was very nice. Believe me, I felt like every ISKCON devotee should take. But then the trainers, all the Maharajas, they said, well, we are only training the some people and they can train their people. Like that. He said that the leaders constantly adjust up. What is material, what is spiritual, he maintains an attitude. The first. Second, full dedication to Srila Prabhupada's teachings.
Mm-hmm.
He does not deviate from Prabhupada's teachings. And his sadhana is exemplary. He should always act as a madhyama adhikari and preach. Preaching means giving vision to anybody comes in front of him.
Mm-hmm.
Or whenever he's preaching, means giving them a vision. And then encouraging to use their intelligence, which will guide as a missionary activities. Anyway, it goes
very
on
nice.
And on.
It's almost like a Rajarshi, right?
Perfect Rajarshi.
Yeah.
Actually, this ISKCON leadership is better than other Rajarshis.
Hmm.
Because ultimately, it will bring to Krishna consciousness and pure prem. Even if I was a perfect Rajarshi in other ages, I would not get love of God.
Hmm.
I would get bhakti, but not bhakti rasa.
Hmm.
When Akshayananda Maharaj asked Prabhupada, how did you come up with the name Krishna consciousness? He said he came from Rupa Goswami Pad's verse in Chaitanya Charitamrita, Krishna bhakti rasa bhavita mati. And Prabhupada translated, Krishna bhakti, what is Krishna bhakti? It's a rasa bhavita mati. It's a relishment by the Brajabasis. So this is the highest that conditioned soul can ever imagine, such a highest benediction. So ISKCON leaders, in a sense, they are the better than other ages Rajarshi.
Because we do not have that in
yes.
our ages.
We should respect ISKCON, I mean Prabhupada and their leaders also.
Yeah. Thank you. Interesting. Anyone else? Any other questions or comments? Yes.
I just want to share this. This is from the Bhagavad Mahatmya. It's a conversation with Narada Muni and Bhakti.
Because you're talking about Kali Yuga. The Brahmins being greedy for wealth are performing Bhagavad Gita in people's houses, and therefore the essence of the Gita is lost. Immoral, atheistic, sinful people have begun to reside in the holy places, causing the influence of those places to be lost. People whose hearts are filled with lust, greed, and anger make a show of performing austerity, and they're causing the essence of penance to be lost. Because people are unable to control their mind, they have taken shelter of greed, pretense, and immorality, and have given up the study of scripture, causing the influence of jnana to be lost. Moreover, the pundits and scholars are only expert in producing children and enjoying sex like buffaloes. This is the difference between Parikshit Maharaj and the common man. Hearing the Srimad Bhagavatam makes a person free from the fear of death. And Parikshit Maharaj heard Bhagavatam for 7 days signifies that we should hear Bhagavatam every day until our death.
Yes,
I just read that this morning and I just thought that was
thank
relevant.
You. Yeah, it's awesome. Yeah, the solution to all this is Bhagavatam.
Yes.
Thank you. Anyone else?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I find that the big king of McDonald's is an exemplary of that. You know, the rice farms for children to make a good image of themselves, but they're killing thousands and thousands of cows every day. And they even, they were defamed because of fast food, and now they're trying to make an image of, oh no, we have these rats that are, you know, very healthy. They're always cheating people like that, you know.
Trickery. Well, we offer, you know, vegetarian choices too.
They're big cheaters just for the sake of their company and money.
Thank you. Yes, absolutely. And since these people are ignorant of what is good for them in Kali Yuga. So it's like they have to follow somebody, right? But they don't know who to follow. So they follow the television or, you know, Trump or whomever, you know.
I have a question.
Yes.
In regards to Rajarshi, I thought Rajarshi is some Rishi who is working for a king or a Raja.
No, Rajarshi is a saintly king. He's a king, but who is also a rishi. But he's a king. Rajarshi is a king.
Rajarshi is a king who is also a saint.
A rishi, yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Not like a saint working for a king.
No.
And Yudhishthi Maharaj is a saint, but he's also Shakti. Can be both.
Well, Rajarshis usually have like other sages and rishis that they take advice from, right? That are sort of under.
They're not Rajarshis.
Raja means king. They are Rishis. I'm sure they have some other title. I'm not sure. But, you know, it happens in the case of King Vena when he became very, you know, sinful, and the sages had to, like, take matters into their own hands and they had to kill him. You know? So every king has his own, like, councils of Rishis. Grantaraj Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai.